Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take a stack of source material, sift through the footnotes of history, and really try to pull out the crucial, unforgettable insights.
That's the goal.
And today we are deep diving into an artist who almost defies category in music, David Bromberg.
Yeah, defining Bromberg. It's like trying to catch smoke, isn't it? I mean, in a music world that really rewards specialization, you know, the blues guitarist, the folk singer, the rock drummer.
Right, stick to your lane.
Exactly. Bromberg is this crucial, versatile, and just profoundly eclectic force in American music. He spans everything from the 60s folk boom right up to today, moving between genres like it's nothing.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to get past that sort of surface-level Wikipedia entry and really figure out how one guy became the ultimate musical polymath.
A tall order, but a good one.
We need to understand the architecture.
Yeah.
You know, how did he master so many instruments? How did he blend genres so seamlessly, mentor actual rock legends, and become Bob Dylan's preferred sideman?
And do it all with that unique, kind of quirky, humorous voice. It's a lot to unpack.
It really is. So yeah. Maybe start with the tools. The instruments.
Okay, yeah. To even begin answering that, you have to grasp the sheer scope of his technical skill. When we say multi-instrumentalist, the sources are super clear. Bromberg's core skill set includes vocals, guitar, fiddle, dobro, mandolin, and pedal steel guitar.
That's not just dabbling. That's a serious collection of skills.
It's a commitment to several really specialized, difficult disciplines. Each one of those could be a lifetime study.
It wasn't just playing like folk music on all of them, right?
Yeah, not at all. He was a key player in bluegrass rock, blues rock, folk rock, jazz rock, country rock, and just plain old rock and roll.
Yeah.
To operate across all those fusion genres at the same time. I mean, think about it. That's like being fluent in 7 different musical languages.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And what really stands out in the sources, what defines that David Bromberg aesthetic, are 2 key things. First, yeah, the quirky, humorous lyrics. He could be witty, observational, sometimes a bit sideways.
Okay.
But second, and this is the technical insight we really need to focus on, is his almost unheard of ability as a guitarist to play rhythm and lead guitar simultaneously.
Simultaneously? How does that even work?
It's a specific technique. Very complex. It's a skill very few guitarists in any genre, really, can pull off with his level of independence and, frankly, speed.
Okay, that's definitely something we need to dig into. Let's unpack this versatility then. Where did it all start? The lineage, the training.
Right, the foundation.
So, David Bromberg, born 1945, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Raised in Tarrytown, New York. And his background, it seems, valued social and intellectual stuff.
That's right. And there's a significant family connection that's kind of unexpected. He's the grandson of Brugcherny Vlad.
Zelotek, the labor leader.
And politician. The very same. A prominent figure. So while Bromberg became this master musician, he came from a family deeply rooted in intense community engagement, public life. You can sometimes hear echoes of that maybe in the social commentary woven into his humor later on.
Interesting connection. So then the 60s hit. He's at Columbia College, Columbia University. Big time for change.
Huge time. And while, yeah, he was getting a formal education, his time there became absolutely pivotal for a completely different reason. Musical apprenticeship.
Okay, so this is where the guitar magic starts.
This is the absolute foundation. This is where we start to answer that question of how he learned to play rhythm and lead at the same time. While he was at Columbia, he started training with the legendary blues and folk figure, Reverend Gary Davis.
The Reverend Gary Davis, wow.
Yeah, and Davis wasn't just a performer. He was a hugely influential teacher, a master of that complex Piedmont finger-picking style.
We keep mentioning this technique, Piedmont style. For listeners who might not know, Why is that connection, that style, so foundational? What does it actually let you do?
Okay, so it's basically everything for his versatility. The Piedmont style demands phenomenal hand independence. Imagine this. Your thumb is playing a steady, driving bass line, sometimes syncopated, sometimes straight, acting like the rhythm section.
Like a built-in bass player.
Exactly, holding down the groove. Meanwhile, your other fingers are flying over the strings, picking out the melody, adding fills, playing lead lines, all at the same time.
So the thumb is the rhythm section, the fingers the soloist, and the harmony. All on one guitar.
Precisely. It lets a single guitarist sound like two, maybe even three musicians playing at once. It's incredibly complex but powerful.
Okay, I can see how mastering that would make you adaptable.
Totally. It meant Bromberg could handle virtually any American folk or blues style thrown at him. And crucially, it meant he was incredibly self-sufficient as a solo act. But just as importantly, it made him adaptable enough to be the ultimate chameleon accompanist.
The perfect sideman.
Which is exactly how his early career really took off. By the mid-60s, that mastery gets him noticed in the really competitive Greenwich Village folk scene. He's working solo, but also, critically, as that highly sought-after session guy, the accompanist everyone wanted.
Building that reputation.
Yeah, and that technical skill, that Piedmont foundation, it just laid the groundwork for his rise as, well, the ultimate sideman. His reputation grew fast because he didn't just play one kind of guitar well.
He played all the key instruments.
Right? Exactly. For that whole burgeoning Americana, folk rock, country rock scene, think about that list again. Acoustic guitar, electric guitar, fiddle, pedal steel, dobro.
That's a studio owner's dream list for one musician.
Totally. It meant he could walk into almost any session, country rock, blues, pure folk, whatever, and provide that specific sound, that specialized instrument texture that lifts the whole track.
And that utility, that versatility, it led him straight to one of the biggest names imaginable, Bob Dylan.
The Dylan connection is huge, especially because it happened during a really critical and frankly often turbulent phase of Dylan's career. Bromberg played on two of Dylan's 1970 albums. Self-Portrait and New Morning.
Self-Portrait. That was the one that got really mixed reviews, wasn't it? Very different.
Yeah, notoriously experimental, often criticized for moving away from Dylan's acoustic roots. Covers, strange production.
Okay, so analyze this for us. Why was Bromberg, supposedly one of Dylan's preferred musicians, during this particular, maybe difficult time?
Well, I think it speaks volumes about Bromberg's temperament and his sheer speed, his efficiency. Dylan is famously selective, right? And right. He was working fast on these albums, exploring shifting, sometimes kind of chaotic, sonic ideas.
Notoriously impatient in the studio, people say.
Right. And Bromberg, probably because of that intense training with Reverend Gary Davis, he was this low-ego, high-utility player. He could instantly grasp what Dylan was going for, whether it was a specific fiddle part, a blues riff, a gentle acoustic texture, and just nail it, often on the first take.
No fuss, just gets it done.
Exactly. That reliability, that instant adaptability, it made him indispensable to an artist like Dylan, who really valued intuition and speed over endless discussion.
Okay, that makes sense. And that reliability, that reputation, it set the stage for a massive turning point in 1970, right? The Isle of Wight Festival.
Oh, yeah. Isle of Wight was this enormous cultural moment, hundreds of thousands of people, huge lineup. He was actually there backing up another folk singer, Rosalie Sorrells.
Okay, so just doing a sideman gig.
Initially, yes. But then, after her set, the sources describe this pretty extraordinary thing happening. Bromberg gets pushed out, or maybe volunteers. It's a bit hazy to do an impromptu solo set.
Whoa. Unplanned. In front of that massive crowd.
Totally unplanned showcase. Just him and his guitar, maybe fiddle on one of the biggest stages in the world at that time. A spontaneous display of everything we've been talking about.
So here's Bromberg, Mr. Reliable Sideman, suddenly thrust into the solo spotlight. What happened? How did it go?
The success was apparently immediate and overwhelming. The energy, the technical skill, the personality. It was so undeniable that it led directly to him being offered a recording contract with Columbia Records.
Just like that, from an impromptu set.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
In one festival weekend, he goes from being Bob Dylan's valued but maybe background player to a headline artist with a major label deal. That's an explosive career shift.
That's incredible. And even before that solo debut album came out, his session work resume was already getting pretty packed, wasn't it? People like Jerry Jeff Walker, Richie Havens.
Oh, yeah. He was already the guy people wanted on their records. The Isle of Wight just put him on a whole different trajectory.
Okay, so Columbia contract secured. 1972, he releases his self-titled debut, David Bromberg. And it wasn't just like a straight folk record, was it?
No, not at all. It immediately cemented that reputation as a cross-genre phenomenon. It had blues, it had folk, hints of rock. It was all in there.
Yeah, and it had some big names helping
That's
out.
Right. Oh yeah, star-studded right out of the gate. One of his own compositions, Sammy's Song, it featured harmonica from his recent boss, collaborator, and now friend Bob Dylan.
Having Dylan on your debut, that's a pretty good endorsement.
Doesn't hurt. But the really fascinating moment, maybe the deep cut that kind of changes how you view his influence, involves George Harrison.
The Beatle.
George Harrison.
The very same. This is a key aha moment from the sources we looked at. The track is called The Hold Up.
The Hold Us. Okay.
Right. So George Harrison actually co-wrote the song with Bromberg and played on the track for that 1972 debut album.
Co-wrote with a Beatle for his first album? That's huge.
Massive. And it was a commercially successful collaboration, too. They issued it as a single, got a lot of play on U.S. progressive radio back then. And even much later, a 1998 review called it perhaps Bromberg's best-known work, so it had lasting impact.
Okay, so great song, big collaboration, but you said the influence goes deeper.
Much deeper. Bromberg fundamentally influenced George Harrison's own playing, his technique. Wait, hang on. Bromberg influenced George Harrison's guitar technique. How? How does the sideman influence the legend?
It comes down to one specific instrument, the dobro.
The dobro, we mentioned that earlier.
Right. The sources are quite specific. Bromberg introduced George Harrison to the dobro. Now, for listeners maybe not familiar, the dobro isn't just any acoustic guitar. It's a resonator guitar, often with a square neck, played horizontally, lap style, using a metal slide or bar.
So totally different from playing slide on a regular guitar with a slide on your finger.
Completely different setup, feel, and technique. It produces this very distinctive, metallic, singing, sustained tone. Very different from a bottleneck slide on a standard electric or acoustic.
Okay.
So Bromberg, being the master of these, you know, niche but crucial stringed instruments, essentially gave Harrison access to this whole new sound palette. And the sources say this introduction directly influenced Harrison's development as a slide guitarist. It opened up a new tonal world for George, a sound that became really key to his solo work throughout the 70s and beyond. That signature slide sound owes a debt to Bromberg handing him a dobro.
So let me get this straight. Bromberg, the guy who just got his first solo record deal, wasn't just getting help from giants like Dylan and Harrison. He was actively shaping their instrumental development. He gifted George Harrison a core part of his future sound.
That's what the record suggests. It's an incredible testament to the respect his specific technical knowledge commanded even back then.
That's more than just being a good player. That's being a musical resource.
Absolutely. It proves his technical expertise was like currency. It wasn't just valuable for playing on a track. It was pedagogically influential. He was operating at the highest level, earning the respect of the absolute best in the business, and apparently teaching them a thing or two.
Mind blown a little bit there.
Okay, right. So if we want to really grasp the full David Bromberg aesthetic, that blend of humor, storytelling, and just sheer musical range, we absolutely have to look at a defining track from his next album. It's his 7-minute version of Mr. Bojangles from the 1972 album Demon in Disguise.
7 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, that's long for a song, especially back then for radio play.
Mm.
But this version, it got played on progressive rock radio. That was a huge platform.
It was. And the reason it got played, the reason it was so captivating, was the unique structure. He took Jerry Jeff Walker's classic song, which is already a story song, right?
Yeah, beautiful, sad story.
Beautiful song. But Bromberg turned it into this immersive, almost theatrical, anecdotal experience. The actual singing of the song was interwoven with these long, detailed, often really funny stories about traveling with the song's author, Jerry Jeff Walker, stories about the road, about the characters they met.
So he, like, stopped the song and just tell a story for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, basically. He'd ramble, tell these shaggy dog tales, then seamlessly slide back into the melody. It must have seemed like a huge commercial risk interrupting the music like that.
Definitely unconventional. What did progressive radio, which was usually about complex jams or concept albums, see in that?
I think they saw authenticity, raw, unfiltered personality, and a performer who was treating his audience like intelligent people who wanted more than just the song. Bromberg was essentially innovating, kind of like a live concept album track.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't just performing the lyrics, he was giving you the world around the song, the context, the flavor, the lived experience that birthed the music itself. He was selling the feeling of being on the road with these guys, not just the notes.
It's like the difference between reading a postcard and getting a long, rambling phone call from a friend.
Exactly. That blend of masterful musicianship, because the playing was still superb, and that captivating, funny, rambling personality, that's what really cemented the Bromberg aesthetic for a lot of people.
And that versatility, that ability to be funny one minute and technically brilliant the next, it meant he was still everyone's first call for sessions, right?
Oh, absolutely.
He never had to turn down a gig because it wasn't his style. Look at his work just in 1973, for example. Jonathan Edwards' album, Have a Good Time For Me. On that one record, Bromberg played mandolin, dobro, and electric guitar.
Three completely different sounds and skills on one project.
Exactly. He could provide whatever textural voice was needed, that chameleon quality, that, let's call it musical promiscuity. It's why his Sideman discography from the 70s is just mind-boggling. He moves seamlessly between genres and major acts.
Okay, let's just run through a few examples from the sources, just to show the sheer range. Willie Nelson.
Yep, played on Willie's seminal 1973 album Shotgun Willie. That's basically a foundational text for the whole outlaw country movement. Playing on that required grit, roots, authenticity.
Okay, outlaw country. Then fast forward just 2 years, the Eagles. Right. 1975, contributing to the Eagles one of these nights. That's quintessential, highly polished West Coast rock. Totally different vibe.
Yeah, the skills for an Eagles section precision blend, maybe a bit more polish, seem worlds away from the looseness you might want with Willie Nelson.
But Bromberg could deliver both. Flawlessly.
And his network wasn't just U.S.-based or stuck in one genre sphere. Carly Simon.
Her self-titled debut in 1971, yeah. And he worked with Ringo Starr multiple times on the Ringo album in 73, and again on Ringo the Fourth in 77. So folk pop, Beatle-related rock.
Okay, this is getting wild. John Prine.
Maintained his folk and Americana cred, absolutely. Played on John Prine's Brilliant Diamonds in the Rough in 1972.
So folk, country, pop, rock. What else?
Well, here's maybe the most head-spinning genre leap listed in the sources. Ravi Shankar.
Ravi Shankar.
The sitar master.
The one and only. Bromberg contributed to Shankar's 1974 album, Shankar Family and Friends. Okay, hold on. Going from, say, laying down a killer electric slide track for the Eagles to contributing to an album rooted in Indian classical music fusion. That requires a completely different mindset, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Different rhythms, different scales.
Tremendous sensitivity and intellectual flexibility, I'd imagine. It just shows a level of musical understanding that's incredibly rare in popular music. He could fit in anywhere.
It really is impossible to pin him down. His career just proves that point over and over. That agility, combined with deep, deep technical knowledge of all those niche instruments, made him arguably the most desired utility player in music history.
You could make a very strong case for that, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, despite that just staggering output in the 70s, that constant demand, Bromberg did eventually slow down. He went through a period of reduced output, essentially a hiatus from major studio recording that stretched well into the 1990s.
Burnout. The road is tough.
Probably factor. The grind of being that ultimate utility player, constantly shifting gears, traveling, it takes a toll. It can be exhausting.
So when did he come back in a big way?
His return to the studio, his first official studio recording since 1990, came in 2007 with the album Try Me One More Time.
Try Me One More Time.
Okay.
What was the vibe?
It felt like a very conscious, deliberate move back to his core acoustic and folk roots. Very intimate. He covered material that spoke directly to his musical lineage, including Dylan's Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry.
Nice choice.
And Elizabeth Cotton's classic Shake Sugary. Just him and his guitar, mostly. Back to basics.
And how was that received after being away for a while?
It was swiftly and formally recognized. Try Me One More Time got nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Traditional Folk Album.
A Grammy nomination straight out of the gate after the hiatus.
Yep, at the 50th Annual Grammy Awards in 2008. And that nomination was really critical, I think. It validated his foundational artistry, reminded everyone of his deep folk roots, setting him apart, in a way, from all the rock and session work he was also famous for. He was acknowledged again as a pure folk master.
That must have felt good. And it probably served as a great reintroduction, didn't it?
Absolutely. Because his next major project, the 2011 album Use Me, sure, he hadn't just returned to his roots. He still commanded massive respect across the entire industry, regardless of genre or generation.
Use Me. What was the concept there?
It was basically a thesis statement on his career as the ultimate collaborator. The concept was other artists would write or choose a song for him, and then they'd produce and perform it with him.
Oh, interesting. So who was on it?
The guest list is just staggering. It reads like a wing of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Levon Helm.
Wow. The band.
John Hyatt, Dr. John, Keb Mo, Los Lobos, Widespread Panic.
Okay, that's crossing genres and generations right there.
Linda Ronstadt, Vince Gill. I mean, giants spanning blues, country, classic rock, the modern jam band scene, all lining up to work with him.
So that album really demonstrated he wasn't seen as some kind of relic, right? He was an active, respected elder statesman.
Totally. He could effortlessly pull together these huge names. People viewed him as someone who brought, you know, credibility, authenticity, and crucially, musical elevation to any track he touched. They wanted to use his talent, hence the title.
Very cool. And this wasn't just a one-off return, was it? He kept recording.
Oh, yeah. The hiatus was decisively over. He maintained a pretty active recording schedule well into his 70s. Albums like Only Slightly Mad in 2013, then The Blues, The Whole Blues, and Nothing But The Blues in 2016.
Okay. Leaning into the blues there.
Definitely. And Big Road in 2020. He was fully back as a dedicated band leader, really refocusing on his core identity as a masterful blues and Americana interpreter, still playing incredibly well.
Now, here's a part of his story that seems almost like a fascinating contrast. His life away from touring settled in Wilmington, Delaware, with his wife, the artist Nancy Josephson. We know him as this legendary musician, but for a number of years, he was also an entrepreneur in a completely different field.
That's right. It's a really interesting chapter. For several years, they owned and ran David Bromberg Fine Violins.
Fine violins, like classical violins.
Exactly.
An extensive sales and repair shop specializing in high-end violins, violas, cellos, classical stringed instruments. They eventually sold the business at the end of 2021.
Okay, the master of the electric slide, the dobro, the pedal steel, the guy who jammed with Dylan and taught Harrison, dedicated a big chunk of his later life to the painstaking craft of luthery, making and repairing violins.
Yeah. What does that tell you about him?
Well, it seems to underscore this deep, almost obsessive respect for the mechanics of music, maybe. It wasn't just about playing. It was about understanding the instrument itself, its physics, its craft.
I think that's spot on. It's such a huge contrast to the chaos of the road life, right? Treating the demands of the recording studio or the stage for the quiet, meticulous, focused work of instrument repair and curation, it really speaks to a man dedicated to craft over just fame or performance.
A different kind of mastery.
A different but related mastery.
Yeah. And his impact in Wilmington, it seems, went beyond the violin shop. He became part of the community fabric. Very much so. He and his wife became major donors to the local Grand Opera House, where he'd also perform occasionally. And he was a regular performer at the World Cafe Live Wilmington, located in the Queen Theater, up until around 2017.
So he wasn't just living there. He was actively investing his time, talent, and resources into the local cultural scene.
Right, fully integrating into his chosen community, which is pretty cool.
Which brings us up to a more recent development. The announcement about touring. The final farewell.
Sort of. In 2023, Bromberg, who was 77 at the time, stated pretty clearly that he was finished with the intense demands of touring with his big band.
The big band, that's a lot of logistics, a lot of people to move around.
Exactly. Road life is brutal anyway, but coordinating a large ensemble like that,
yeah,
it's a massive undertaking, especially as you get older. So the official farewell concert with the David Bromberg Big Band was this celebrated event at the Beacon Theater in New York City, June 10th, 2023.
End of an era, in a way.
In a way.
Yeah.
It's really important to clarify the distinction the sources make that he made. He said he's had it with touring, meaning the constant packing, moving, airports, hotels, the whole grind.
Yeah, that part sounds exhausting.
But he emphatically did not rule out playing music altogether, not ruling out occasional appearances, maybe festivals, short-term collaborations, local gigs, things that don't involve that relentless travel schedule.
Ah, okay. So the music continues, just not the coast-to-coast, night-after-night touring lifestyle.
Precisely. He's retiring from the road, not necessarily from the music.
Okay, so after this whole deep dive, looking at all these facets, how do we synthesize David Bromberg? We started out trying to define a polymath, and what we seem to have found is this figure who acts as an essential bridge builder in American music.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. He successfully bridged the earnest, foundational acoustic roots of that Greenwich Village folk revival stuff he learned directly at the feet of Reverend Gary Davis with the much more complex, genre-bending, sometimes electric experimentation of 70s rock and what became Americana.
He connects those two worlds.
Directly. His career is kind of the ultimate proof that deep technical mastery, knowing your instrument inside and out, combined with extreme stylistic flexibility, being able to jump between dobro, fiddle, electric guitar, pedal steel, that combination is the definition of a truly preferred, indispensable musician.
He didn't just collect instruments. He mastered their specific languages, which allowed him to, you know, comfortably add mandolin to a country record one week, blistering electric slide to a rock album the next, and then turn around and collaborate with Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, and we absolutely can't forget his maybe greatest aesthetic innovation, using that anecdotal storytelling, like we talked about with Mr. Bojangles, to transform classic songs into these immersive, sprawling 7-minute narratives. He offered performance as this shared, lived-in character experience,
bringing the listener right into the story behind the song.
Exactly. And even his life beyond music, running that fine violin shop, it just reinforces the idea that his connection to music is intellectual, it's mechanical, it's craft-based, as much as it is purely artistic or performance-based. Mm. He's dedicated to the whole ecosystem of music, playing it, understanding the tools used to make it, fixing them, maybe even passing on the knowledge.
Which does raise a really interesting final question for you, the listener, to maybe chew on as we close out here.
Okay.
Given his career-long habit of blending music and storytelling, his deep respect for craft, and the fact that he's still performing occasionally after stepping back from the big band touring grind, What kind of project might an 80-year-old musical synthesis expert, a master bridge builder, turn to next?
That's a great question. We know from the sources he has put out instructional material before DVDs, like A Guitar Lesson with David Bromberg or The Guitar Artistry of David Bromberg. Does he maybe double down on pedagogy now? Really try to chronicle the full depth of that Reverend Gary Davis Piedmont style for a new generation? Pass a torch formally?
Or does he maybe focus on more curated, perhaps geographically limited, but musically limitless collaborations? Maybe producing or mentoring younger artists who share that eclectic spirit? Using his connections and wisdom in a different way.
Could be either, or something entirely different we haven't thought of. Knowing Bromberg's history, whatever he does, it likely won't be predictable.
A perfect final thought on a man whose next move will undoubtedly be fascinating, guided by that incredible lifetime of technical knowledge and artistic curiosity. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the singular, multifaceted career of David Bromberg.
Been a pleasure.
We'll catch you next time.